Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
It's Brian Lehrer Show, Family Meeting, Growing Up Mixed. We've heard a lot about the Tale of Two Cities recently and the widening gap between the rich and the poor in New York and beyond. So what about the widening gap in your own family? Do you have a sibling who's making gobs of money and more each year while your income stays about the same? How does that play out at Christmas? Or maybe you're from a well-off background, but your partner isn't, and you butt heads when you come to your when it comes to your attitudes towards money. Or what if your partner makes a lot more than you do and it feels like the Tale of Two Cities in your own home? And what if you're the woman who makes a lot more money than the man, or one of you is much more educated and the other of you is not, and so you're sort of professional class and working class? Call us up and talk about how these income differences in your own families play out. 212-433-WNYC. And we're going to talk to a guest in a second who has written an essay about this. But what are the recurring conflicts or awkward situations for you? Does your rich brother offer to pay for stuff, which feels like generosity but also kind of like charity? Does your family not really get that you don't have as much money and that you can't go to that fancy dinner or take that family trip without really hurting your finances? Does it play out under the Christmas tree? 212-433-WNYC. You know, some gifts are fabulous, and some are modest, but fabulous, and it just feels bad. Call us up, 212-433-9692. Or maybe it's great, and it doesn't get in the way. Maybe having people of all income levels in your family teaches your kids that income is not the measure of a person, or that there's a lot of folks struggling. There are a lot of folks struggling out there. 212-433-9692. Call us up with your conundrums, your resolutions, your stories about having a mixed income, nuclear family, or extended family. 212-433-9692. And joining us for this is Jenna Malamud-Smith. She's a psychotherapist and author of many books. She's also written something for the Daily Beast this year about the rising income inequality inside families as financial fortunes diverge. Hi, Jenna. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi.
So you're a psychotherapist, and you've seen this income disparity within families become more and more of an issue with your clients. So this is not just about our economic health, this inequality we have today. It's about our mental health?
Absolutely. And, you know, there are beginning to be some studies that suggest that there's more anxiety and depression in cultures where there's more income disparity. So I'm not sure it's just in families. I think it's bigger than that, and it just gets lived out in the family. One of the sort of the most daunting examples people have probably heard about, for medical illness for a second, is that if you take a British civil servant and you demote him one level in the huge hierarchy of British civil servants, he becomes much more likely to have a heart attack. It's significant, statistically significant. And I think it happens physically, and I think it happens emotionally. And I think it's sort of the downside of the kind of income disparity that we seem to be encouraging.
And do you think the income gap is getting more and more extreme within families?
Yeah, it has to be, because I think that the tiny 0.01% of people who actually have massive income tend to all have families, and it's just really hard for two people in the same family to do something that extraordinary.
And you, in the business of psychotherapy, call it relative deprivation, I've seen. So if you don't know that you're deprived, you don't feel deprived. But if you bump up against people who make greater or lesser amounts and they're right in your orbit, maybe right under the same roof, or extended family gathering at Christmas time, and one is giving, you know, their kids in front of you $500 computers, and, you know, you're giving $50 whatevers, you feel it more.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the ways I learned this lesson was years ago I worked in a housing project clinic for a long time. And, you know, there's that social kind of cliche about, oh, isn't it terrible, all these very poor people who give their kids really expensive sneakers. But I realized that actually that was a hugely generous thing these parents were doing, because they were trying to say to their kids, you're as good as those kids who have more money. We want you to have some of those symbols of status so that you can hold your head up, because they're so important in our culture. And conversely, the story I like to tell is we go every summer to a Maine island, and I've done interviewing of a lot of the people who grew up on that island, and everybody grew up poor. And what they said was, you know, we had terrific childhoods, and the reason we did was we felt like everybody in our whole community was in the same boat.
So how can families deal with this dynamic in a way where everyone feels okay? Because if there's a bottom line point to doing this whole family meeting special today on growing up mixed in various ways, it's to help people navigate. Funny that the easiest one to get stories of actual divorces on was people who couldn't get along with their spouse's politics. But, you know, this income inequality, it isn't something you plan necessarily. It isn't something you choose. Like, I know I'm Jewish and marrying a Catholic woman or something like that. So is there a way, are there ways that families can deal with these mixed income tensions?
Well, I think there probably are as many ways as there are families to deal with it. But I think that what's painful is it's often not dealt with so very well. Either people feel it can't be talked about at all, or it becomes a source of resentment on the part of people who have less in a way that they kind of feed on but don't ever put words on, or it becomes a source of awkwardness. And, you know, oftentimes since people seek out their own, it also can divide people in big ways in families, so that there can become so much discomfort over some of these differences that people just sort of avoid each other for not wanting to feel the awkward feelings.
Let's take a phone call. John, on the Upper West Side, you're on WNYC.
Hi,
John.
Brian. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you.
So, you know, early on in the relationship, long relationship, of course I was the major earner, the person making more money, and I helped my wife go through school and graduate school and training in the beginning of a career. And, you know, now she's become a great, you know, therapist, and she's making lots of money. And you know, my business is slowed down over the years, and I'm sort of like the kind of person that, hey, once you've paid off your credit cards and you have a little money to leave your kids and stuff, you know, you don't need to go around accumulating lots and lots more money. So my, you know, salary and income has relatively stayed the same, but she's gotten more and more, and I think that's great. But there's slight resentment on her part that I'm not earning more money and keeping up with her and going out there and, you know, getting more money. And I wonder, what do you think, where you've been helping your spouse, could be the other way around, wife helping husband helping wife, get through the beginning of their life, and then the resentment starts later.
So psychotherapist Jana Malibin-Smith, can you help John?
Well, first of all, I just want to make a nod to your thoughtfulness about it. And it is, what's another interesting thing about your story is that the shoe is usually on the other foot. So often we hear about women who put their husbands through medical school and so forth, so that culturally we're not as used to your situation. And I think in some ways that makes it harder for you, because the stereotype is, no matter how hard we try, we so far aren't beyond it completely, that somehow the guy has to be the bigger breadwinner. So it's more pressuring. But I think that conversation, what happens when the two of you try to sit down and just sort of say, you know, remember when I put you through graduate school and I feel like I did my piece and I kind of love what I do, even if it doesn't make as much money? I mean, how much do you think is really her, and how much do you think maybe is that you feel a little guilty about it, I guess?
I'm sorry, I was listening to something else for a second. Did you just ask John a follow-up question?
I did.
He's not there anymore.
Okay.
He hung up to listen.
I'm sorry. So I was asking him how much was he felt that he really resented her, and how much was that he felt a little bit guilty. I was actually speaking sort of directly to him about.
And what's that tension between the resentment, or what's the difference there really between the resentment and the guilt?
Well, I mean, the resentment really is, God, I want what you have, and and or I want you to work as hard as I'm working, or I don't want to be alone in this. And the guilt is much more, oh, I love what I do and I'm not making much money and maybe I should and so forth.
Yeah, and I guess maybe it's different if somebody feels that their partner isn't trying to make more money to bring into the home versus if somebody is trying but they're just down on their luck.
Right. Well, I think there's more to it than that, Brian. I think it's also that we have become – there was a wonderful thing that somebody wrote a few years ago talking about the money-making in the Silicon Valley in the 90s. He said, you know, that money was being made so fast that the fig leaf of culture could barely stretch to cover it. And I think that there are ways of making money so fast now that we have forgotten that there are so many other things of value in life. I mean, we say that there are, you know, oh yeah, isn't it wonderful you're working in a soup kitchen, or that you're volunteering, or that you're you know, you're playing your violin, which you really love, even if it isn't very lucrative. We say all these things to people, but culturally we just don't value them enough, and it's a terrible bind that we put people in. So that if a person, like my husband's been a high school teacher his whole life, and I've been a social worker, neither of us have earned a lot of money, but boy, do we love what we do. But there's always this kind of, aren't you lucky that you get to do something you love, kind of line. And yet it often comes from people who maybe are also just delighted that they have made so much money. I mean, it's a complicated cultural moment.
And I think maybe Brendan in Astoria's story is relevant to that. Brendan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Brendan.
Hey, how are you?
Good. So your wife is the breadwinner?
Yeah, my wife's the breadwinner. She's an art director for a marketing firm, and I'm an artist.
Uh-huh, a starving artist, except that you're being supported by your wife.
Yes.
And
she's very generous.
How do you both feel about this?
Well, when we first met, I was working part-time at a museum. I was a museum educator, and she knew that how much income I was bringing in. But after we got married, it was about a month into it, and she asked me what my plan was. And there was nothing was going on between my ears. It was like somebody turned off the television set, and I panicked. And that was when I realized that, you know, I've been an artist for about 20 years, and I've just been completely accustomed to this living hand-to-mouth, this idea of, like, just a life of deprivation. Like, I can get by on the littlest amount of money. And then when I got married, you know, I realized that wasn't going to work in a partnership with my wife. And we're definitely muddling through it. I think, you know, definitely for the first year, I was very scared. I reacted kind of poorly. I would shut down. I was afraid to talk about it. I felt really guilty. And now we've tried to make a point to at least once a month to sit down, to talk about money, to talk about, you know, where the money's coming in, how much, you know, I'm bringing in, how much she's bringing in, where we can go. But it's definitely, my first inclination is to always feel like my back is against the wall. And she, for her part, you know, she's like, I know where you're coming from, because we actually met in art school.
She's an art director in the corporate world, and
yeah,
you're making your stuff, and you want to be able to have that freedom. So how do you see the resolution to this coming down, or do you have trouble seeing it?
I think, you know, I have trouble seeing it in the sense that when it comes to, I would like to be able to provide more money. I'd like to be able to provide more income for our family. And where it comes down to is, as a 40 years old, it's like, I don't know how marketable my skills as an artist are, and how it can translate into a more, you know, a lucrative, like a more lucrative position. So it's like, I've sent out hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of resumes in the last 3 years, you know, trying to make that transition to a more, I guess, stable position. And, you know, there's just nothing out there. So,
Brendan, I'm going to leave it there and get a word for you from our guest. There's so many things going on there. You know, that was a surprise ending to me, which is that he's really trying to now go out and get a, quote, normal job. Because the whole first part of the story was about how they really had different attitudes toward money.
Right, and I think it says again that, you know, if we had a really healthy middle class, if the minimum wage had been going up, if we took care of people better than we do, these situations wouldn't be so dire. There'd be a bunch more of these of jobs in the center, so that people could go out and retool and find some of these jobs more easily where the skills are closer to what they love to do. It's that we've wiped out those middle positions by and large that's making this so much harder.
And on our comments page, somebody just going by initial C writes, my fiance grew up in an almost 1% household, and I definitely did not. I'm always amazed and a little envious how he doesn't worry about money. It's something he's never had to stress about. Even though we both have well-paying jobs, I'm always making contingency plans in the back of my mind in case something goes horribly awry.
Yeah, that's beautifully said.
And, you know, that reminds me of another story that I heard about recently. I was talking to someone who says that while she and her partner make about the same amount of money, they have different ideas about whether they're well off or not.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that interesting? One thinks they're privileged and have a responsibility to be charitable with their money, and the other thinks they're not well off enough to give much of their money away. And it has to do with how they grew up.
Exactly. I mean, you can so understand it, can't you? That for one, you know, maybe it feels like that their adulthood is Santa Claus every day because it's so much more bountiful than what they had. And for the other one, it feels like, oh, my God, is this going to be enough? Because it might be less than what they're used to. And, you know, the more these gaps are, the more difficult it is. And just another way of thinking about it, recently I was flying on the airlines. I don't fly a lot, and so I was in what I call nothing class. You know, they call you to sit down, and they have the platinum, and they have the gold, and they have the this and the that and that. And they have this phenomenal hierarchy of who has status as a person flying. And by the time they call the nothing class, you know, you begin to feel like nothing. And I think we do this. The more we get the distance between rich and poor in this country, the more that feeling of anxiety and nothing is lingering over so many people so much of the time.
I love that, the nothing class on the airplane. Oh, okay, I guess you can board too. Go ahead.
That's right. You poor scum of the earth, you know.
Sean in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, pleasure to be talking with you.
What's your situation?
I can relate to the previous caller in that my wife is technically the breadwinner, whereas he's gone from kind of a non-traditional, non-conforming job. I am leaving the very conformed world of engineering to start my own brewing company. The issue with my family dynamic is my parents are engineers. It's our family business. My girlfriend is also an engineer. They don't approve, whereas my in-laws are incredibly supportive and, like, actually, you know, help me with my bottling and labeling operations.
What is it they don't approve of on your side?
I went to a traditional top-tier engineering school. I've been in the industry since I was 18 doing internships. And I guess you could say I left the industry on a whim. It was
is it that they look down their noses at the brewery business? Is it that they're afraid for your financial security? Where do you think it really comes from?
I think it comes down to they think that I'm just leaving to just do my hobby all day. They also don't necessarily believe in craft beer. They think it's a big fad. So for them, they're
so if you were working if you were working for Coors, it would be all right.
Yeah, absolutely. they would think that would be great. If I was designing draft systems for Coors, oh man, they'd be so happy.
Sean, thank you very much. I'm going to go from his story to Michelle in Pleasantville. Michelle, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. So, what's your story?
So, I came from a different background than my husband. I grew up actually in a kibbutz in Israel. So that's where my parents are still living now. And my husband, when I met him, we were dating. He was a financial analyst, and his background, his family background, you know, they're bankers and things like that. And, I mean, I always felt that, like, the different level, also what my family could provide compared to what his family could provide, you know, experience, too, for, and now that we have children, too, I think it continues on. He knew that he was marrying me, and, you know, this family, my background was never going to change, probably as long as my parents continued to live there. But even now, when we're hanging out, even with our families together, my husband's a teacher, and his brother's already retired, it's kind of like just finding like that, having them aware that we can't, you know, always do everything they can do. Like, my question is, how do you get the other side to, like, kind of see, you know, what it is that...
Right.
How
do we say that we can't go to that fancy dinner?
Right. Exactly.
Jana?
Every night.
Every night when you're on vacation. Yeah. Jana?
Yeah. Boy, that's a tough one. I think I'm going to go around to the side of this just for a second and say that part of it is that it's so hard now in the culture to articulate what the really valuable part, for example, why people went to kibbutzes, what was in their hearts, what were the values that were guiding them, and why those values mattered so much too. And because culturally we don't articulate those values, it becomes really hard to do it, and it becomes sort of on this kind of tight, oftentimes uncomfortable personal conversation. And you know, I think honestly probably the best thing is to try to make it as light as you can and not go for the meat until somebody asks you about it. But
the thing is, they always offer, of course they're going to offer and they'll offer, but sometimes, you know, we feel like we wish we don't have to say yes because we want to be, you know, like it's just the balance of, you know, sometimes even helping, which is a kind thing, makes us feel a little bit less because we, you know. Just to enjoy experiences in general, like rather than experiences that cost money, like we're more about that in our family, and that's what we want our family and everybody else in the family to understand. Like, let's do more of those things that don't cost money.
Yeah,
you know?
and I think that maybe it's fair to just say, look, we'll go out to dinner, but we want you to come join us in our way of having fun next time. We want to give you something. We really like giving, too. I remember when I worked in the housing projects, one of the most amazing things I ever saw was somebody who had been stealing medical supplies from the hospital, and the reason she was doing it turned out is she really liked giving them to her sick neighbors, so she felt like she had something to give. And one of the biggest deprivations that we create in society is when we deprive people of that good feeling of having something to give, because that's where all of our dignity and the warmth in our hearts resides, and we all want to have that.
So Jana Malamud-Smith, psychotherapist, author of many books, author of a Daily Beast article this year about the rising income inequality inside families as financial fortunes diverge. Thank you so much for talking to our callers and giving advice today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with our Brian Lehrer Show Family Meeting, Growing Up Mixed.
I bet we've been together for a million years.
And I bet we'll be together for a million more.
Oh, it's like I started breathing on the night we kissed. And I can't remember